Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining me for this live Heretics Hour broadcast that's going to be quite special. It's Monday, January 19th, 2015, and I'm Carolyn Yeager, your host. My guest is the always popular Margaret Huffstickler, and the topic she's bringing us tonight is the Dreyfus Affair. Now, I tried to call Margaret just while the intro music was playing, but the call failed, so I'm going to have to start all over again and do it while we're on the air. So here we go. Bear with me, please. Get this. I've got the phone number in there. They don't seem to like it. I'm going to type the number in one more time, see why this doesn't work. She'll have to call me. Let's see if this works now. I sure hope so. It's dialing. So we definitely need to get Margaret on here. There we go. There we go. I'm going to put her on. Success.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yes, I hear you, Margaret.
Oh, good.
Yeah, so I was going to say, welcome to the program, Margaret.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here and to share this information.
Well, right. This is going to be exciting and kind of a fun program. I've been studying up on it somewhat, but you're the expert on it, and it's extremely convoluted and involved. And what
purposely so.
Right. Yeah. There's a lot that could be commented on. I'm going to try to keep my mouth shut unless I need to break in or to help move things along or something. But it's what strikes me just overall is that it was everything is backwards about it. I mean, everything that is true is presented as false. And all the good people, now the people who were good in that time are now seen as bad people and liars and so on.
Yes, it was a very successful operation, yeah. It's
there you go.
Classic example of the Jew cries out as he strikes you.
Yes, okay. Well, why don't you just start in where you want to start?
Okay, let's see. Well, I have this outline of the plot of it, but I'll give a little bit of background to it. This started in 1894 in the general staff of France, and
the French military, right?
Now,
like the French army, or
yeah,
something.
The French general staff. And it's underneath the Minister of War. And this is 24 years after they got their butts handed to them by Germany in the Franco-Prussian War, when Germany got back Alsace-Lorraine. And often when you read about this, the first thing you're going to read in a book is, if they're giving historical background, is this fact, and the fact that I think it was Bismarck remarked to one of the French, we won because we had so much better intelligence than you had, because the French had almost non-existence and the Germans were just all over them. They knew what was going on in advance. So since then, the French have been scrambling to catch up. And, of course, this really takes place in the espionage section of the French army. It was called the Information Bureau, or they also called it the Office of Statistics, to kind of be sneaky about it. And one thing that's good to know is the Germans were still way ahead of them in this. The Germans had like a budget of the equivalent of 30 million francs, and the French had 500,000 francs. So that's a huge difference. And
wow.
Yeah. And at this time, there is an alliance between Austria, Germany, and Italy, kind of against France. It was called the Triplice, the Triple Alliance. And the people we'd be concerned with, the countries, would be more Germany and Italy than Austria. Austria is not really involved in this story. In their embassies, Germany had military attachés, and I guess it was the same for the Italians. They had military attachés whose real jobs were to spy. And the French, when you read the French about this, they're like, this is horrifying that anybody would spy in an embassy. You're not supposed to do that. Well, that's what spies do, I guess. But they had a system. The French had a very nice in to the German embassy and to the military attaché there, who was named Schwarzkoppen. Schwarzkoppen, good German name. They had the French had a woman named Madame Bastien, who was a housekeeper there, a maid there, and she would empty the wastebasket for Schwarzkoppen and hand it to Lieutenant Colonel Henri, who worked for the statistical section, and then he would take it back, and they just didn't even bother to burn their papers. They just would tear him in pieces and put him in the wastebasket, and then she'd deliver them to the statistical section.
Yeah, so let's get this real clear for the listeners. So you have the German embassy in France, and then there is a French woman who's the housekeeper. Not a very
good idea
already. And while she's doing the housekeeping, she knows to look through the wastebaskets.
She just dumps the whole thing into a sack.
Okay.
Cornea, like a paper sack, and takes it to the.
And takes it. So she was a. So she was a spy, and the Germans weren't should have been paying attention to the fact that a French woman cleaning up their wastebaskets is not a very good idea.
Yeah, and also I think it might be good for them to just burn the stuff. But I think a lot of them were under the impression that she was illiterate. Maybe she was just pretty smart that way, because she wasn't illiterate, though many Dreyfusards depict her that way as being like a coarse, illiterate woman. But she seems to have been a very good woman, very honorable, as spies go. I mean, that was her job.
It's funny how in France they call everybody Madame, even if they're a poor cleaning woman.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
So you get the, it's for us, for somebody who's not, French, it's like, oh, that must be, society woman.
Yeah, Madame.
So-and-so.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've got that clear, how they came upon this.
And they called it the voie ordinaire, the ordinary route, because they just used it all the time. And they got a lot of good stuff from there. And let me, before I go on with this, I'll just tell you a little bit about the way the statistical section was organized, so you know who I'm talking about a little bit, maybe. It's not very much, I'll tell you. The Minister of War at that time was General Mercier, and he's the one who's going to have the authority later to have Dreyfus arrested. And below him is the head of the General Staff, who's General Bois d'Effre. And then just below him, the subhead of the General Staff is the one who people report to from the statistics office. He's right above them, and he's General Gans. So below him, you've got the statistical section, and the head of the statistical section, his name is Santerre, and he really put the statistical section together. In the past 6 years since he's been working there, I think it was 6 years, he's really gotten it working well. And then there are various people below them, and two that will have a lot to do with are Dupaty de Clam, who's a very aristocratic name. He's going to be doing investigation of Dreyfus, and Lieutenant Colonel Henri, or he starts out as a colonel, then he becomes a lieutenant colonel. So, and then there's a captain. No, he's also a lieutenant colonel, Picard. And he's going to take over the office after Santerre is perhaps poisoned. So here we are in the statistical section, and they've just gotten a delivery from the Voie Ordinaire, and it's 1894. And they get this delivery, and they start putting it together. Henri puts it together. In fact, his wife testifies later. He was putting it together at the dining room table at home. And it's like, ooh, look what this is. It's a very important a paper. They call it a border row, which means it's an itemized list. And it's a list of things that this person has either given to the general, to the German military attaché, or is going to. And it's things like a note on the hydraulic brake on the 120 millimeter cannon. Now, this is very important because the Germans didn't have this brake, and it makes the cannon fire much more efficiently if you've got a good brake, so you won't have too much recoil. So all of these are very important information that are in this list. It's five very important things. Then there's a note on covering troops. That, I don't really understand covering troops, but I guess it's troops that cover the other troops. Then there's a note on a modification in the artillery formations, a note relating to Madagascar. They're about to invade Madagascar. And a proposal for a firing manual for field artillery. So these are all very important pieces of information. And this guy's like, oh, here's an itemized list of the things I'm giving you. So they're like, oh, my God. And the thing is, this doesn't come out of the blue because they've been getting messages saying that there's somebody in the general staff who's selling secrets. There's a Spanish attaché who's got a French wife, and he kind of feels connection to the French, and he wrote them a note saying, you've got a wolf in your sheepfold, and he wrote another one saying, you've got somebody in your general staff who's selling secrets to the Germans, but they just don't know what to do about it till they get something more specific. Then here this is, more specific. So they start looking around, and there aren't really that many people who are in a position to give this information away, to even have this information. What they realize is that it would be someone who's what they call a stagiaire. He's going through different stages. He's like an intern, and he goes through the first department, the first bureau, second bureau, third bureau, fourth bureau, and one of them is artillery. You know, and so these bits of information come from different bureaus. And somebody who was a stagiaire would be in perfect position to give it. Then somebody somebody notices the resemblance of the handwriting to Dreyfus, and so they submit the handwriting to some experts without giving the name of who it is. So people who say, "Oh, they just were being anti-Semitic," you know, these experts had no idea whose handwriting it was. It was just asked if, you know, what they thought. And at first it was given to a man who worked for the Bank of France. And he's like, he says, oh, this is clearly the same or something, but let me take it home. And he came back the next day and he says, oh, whose handwriting is this? And they're like, we're not telling you. Bye. They got other experts because they didn't want somebody who wanted to know whose handwriting it was. And they could tell that he already knew whose handwriting it was. So he'd sort of gotten some word. And this is, the guy who worked for the Bank of France. So that's interesting.
Yeah, so that fits, doesn't it? So that he was on the side of the Jews.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it got narrowed down, and they realized it must be probably Dreyfus, but they didn't want to just go and immediately arrest him. Some of them really thought they should wait and have him followed more. But what they ended up doing was that they had this man, Dupaty de Clam, do a test where he, all this time, Dreyfus was on leave, so he wasn't around anyway. So as soon as he came back from leave, they did this test where Dupaty said, oh, could you take this dictation for me because my hands hurt? And he starts dictating something, and Dreyfus is just writing normally, and he starts putting in phrases from the border row, like maneuvers and artillery and cannon. And as soon as these phrases start coming along, his handwriting changes, and it gets bigger, and it starts as if maybe he's trying to change it. Maybe he cannot look like his anymore. So they end up arresting him. And they all seemed to say the same thing. There were several people there, people who just pretended to be casually in the office. So they were all observing this. And they all said it looked as if he'd prepared for this, and he's being very theatrical and saying, oh, no, I am innocent. And he's looking in the mirror, so they say. That sounds very strange. But at any rate, he's arrested and he's interrogated. And then he's taken to the Cherche Midi prison.
Because his handwriting matched the note.
Yes, that's right, exactly.
It's before he's trying to change it.
That's right. And yeah. And because he tried to change it when he started realizing mm-hmm. what they were doing. I can't think of a single reason for somebody to do that unless they recognized those phrases. And,
right.
You know, it's like an
inadvertent
confession. Yeah.
Right. It is like definitely right.
Mm-hmm. So at this point, I think they made a mistake because they left him alone for 2 days before they interrogated him again. At that point, the papers had gotten hold of it and said Captain Dreyfus arrested, or something, you know, General Staff Officer Dreyfus arrested, and they. There's a story which I think was written down at the time, so it must be true, I think, because it wasn't knowing what happened later that it was written down. The chief of police of Paris got a visit from the head rabbi of France, Zadok Khan, and he said, if you people go ahead with this, there is going to be a war that will split France in two. And he says, you think we can't do it? Well, we can. It was really just so absolutely in your face. It was like somebody calling a pool shot.
And this was the head rabbi.
Head rabbi of France.
Yeah.
I mean, Dreyfus wasn't just any Jew. I mean, he was fairly wealthy and, you know, had a fairly wealthy, prominent wife. But, it wasn't that he was so special. It was that the whole idea, I think, yeah, I think maybe you're right. He was the only Jew on the general staff, and it really set them back because they were just starting to admit more Jews in the military in sensitive positions.
If they were trying to do that, though, it seems silly to take a chance like that. And why was he a part of a larger plan in doing this treason, or would you say
he was doing it
all on his own?
I think he was doing it all on his own. That's my thought.
Making money?
Yeah, you know, Monique Delcroix, and this is, your listeners don't know, I got a lot of information from this great French book. It's a new book that came out just a few years ago in France called Dreyfus Esterhazy. And Esterhazy is the straw man that they put in Dreyfus's place in order to exonerate him. Mm-hmm. And she kind of demolishes that in her book. But she talks about the fact that a flaw in the case against Dreyfus was that he had no motive. Well, how does she know he had no motive? You know, I mean, they did mention motives. They didn't have a definite motive that they knew what his motive was. I mean, whoever knows. But they had a lot of evidence, actually, that he gambled, that he had a mistress, that he was wanting to set up in a house. Now, you might have a lot of money, but that doesn't mean you can spend all your money on gambling and setting up mistresses, and your wife isn't going to get paid.
Or you can't have a record of using the money that is your real money to do that, but if he has money under the table, then he can do all that stuff. It wouldn't be connected to him.
Yeah,
well, I didn't know about that part. That's really good.
Yeah, there are several anecdotes about that. Actually, Piers Paul Reed mentions in his regular Dreyfusard-type book that his wife's mother, his mother-in-law, went to the rabbi, their rabbi, and was complaining that her son-in-law was gambling and wanted to know what to do about it. There's a lot of testimony from fellow soldiers about various things, and one of them is... a companion of his, a comrade, talks about coming back from some maneuvers with him, and they're walking past this house, and Dreyfus looks up and says, we could go visit this friend of mine. She'd be surprised to see us. It's late at night. And then he says, oh, but we better not go there. I lost a lot of money at her house the other night. That means he's been gambling. But he absolutely denies it. Absolutely, you know, when he's questioned, denies it. And he mentioned to another one, he said, wow, I've been losing a lot on the horses recently, but I've got two new colts I think are going to do really well. And that's another thing about him, that he's always flashing around how rich he is compared to the other people.
Well, you never hear about any of this.
No, you don't. No. One of the things they were looking for when they were looking for somebody to investigate was somebody who had bad marks for conduct. Not conduct exactly, but character. And he had very good marks for memory and technical stuff and intelligence. But for character, they really, some of his instructors or his heads in the school and in the departments had very, you know, just not a high opinion of his character. They would say, they said he seems superficial. He's not devoted enough. He's a braggart. He, you know, just various things like that. Mm. And what everybody said is he's so curious. He always, I mean, he wasn't the best spy, you know, to do this. He's always trying to get information he shouldn't have. He's taking notes when they're told not to take any notes. He's running around with these secret documents under his arm. Somebody almost runs over him with a horse. He's walking along with these documents, and they're saying, wow, you're so industrious, you're taking work home. And he's like, no, these are secret documents. I'm taking them to have them copied.
No, he didn't say that.
He did. He said he was doing it for the department, you know. But still, I mean, just that's not very discreet. But, you know, I think maybe he was just kind of, you know, often they have this feeling of invulnerability kind of.
Right.
But, I mean, I don't know, two different
people. Well, a typical kind of person who would do this kind of thing. I think he must have been doing it, from what you've said so far, for money. And
I think probably loyalty.
He's just trying to get ahead in French society there. He doesn't really have any.
Well, he was doing fine in French society. I think it was for his more under the table activities, because he married a rich wife. I mean, he already had money. He had textile factories in Alsace.
Now, was his wife Jewish?
She was Jewish, and she came from a better family than his. I mean, more prestigious, richer, and he got her money. But, you know, if he wants to set up his mistress, he can't be using his wife's money for that and have her asking questions and have a big split in the family, I think. So I would say that was probably it. Liebknecht, I mentioned this to you, and your readers would be interested to know that the socialist, future communist, Jewish activist Karl Liebknecht wrote in 1899 that he never believed that Dreyfus was innocent, and he sort of demolished the idea of motive, that lack of a motive was a problem. He said many people commit crimes that you don't even know what the motive is. You know, he says that's got nothing to do with it. Plenty of rich people are traitors too. But here's the very interesting thing. One, I'm not sure where this information comes from, but in one of the very good books I read that had some of the inside information, I think it probably came out in one of the trials. But one of the suggestions for how he got paid was an insurance payment for a factory at one of his textile factories that had burned down in Alsace, that he was having trouble getting the insurance company to pay. So then all they have to do is, like, subsidize the insurance company so they can make the payment to Dreyfus, and the payment goes through. So then you get Jewish lightning tied in there, and that's kind of interesting. But I didn't, you know, I haven't followed that to the end to know just you know how sound that information is, but it was a suggestion. He's in the Cherche-Midi prison, and they don't interrogate him for 2 days, and I'm sure someone got to him during that time and told him, don't ever confess, you know, because we're going to get you out of it. And in fact, Henri, who took him to the prison, Lieutenant Colonel Henri, said that on the way to the prison, he said, my race will avenge itself on yours. Now, what I want to check with that is, did Henri write that down before anything started happening? Or, I mean, because if so, he probably really did say it. Nobody just makes that up out of the blue. If he wrote it down later.
Yeah, and if he's this arrogant kind of a guy who is kind of reckless, he would. Mm-hmm. It's believable he'd say something like that.
Yeah, because, he was really stinging. You know, he wasn't expecting mm-hmm. this to happen.
Right. And so he was angry.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yes. So anyway, so they go ahead with the trial, and it's a secret trial. It's a huis clos, which is a secret trial, because if they let the information out in the public, then they'll burn their agent, and they won't have the access to the wastebasket of the German mm-hmm. embassy anymore. And also, they'll cause diplomatic repercussions.
And this is all military now? Is this all taking place in the military rather than civil society? Okay.
That's right. It will be a military court-martial. Mm-hmm. Yeah, by the Council of War. And so it takes place in this secret trial, and they have all this other testimony by many, many people on top of the bordereau and its identity of handwriting. And so they find him guilty unanimously, and one of the sentences is degradation. He has his sword broken and his epaulets stripped off. And the papers make a big deal out of that because he's Jewish, you know. I mean, anybody else, you know, he's a traitor. What did he think was going to happen if he got caught?
But the newspapers are already playing up the anti-Semitic angle.
That's right. They already are. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, not all of them, but there's a very famous picture which you see all over of his sword being broken. And this, I downloaded a Kindle version of a new book in France, which has just come out, which says all the same old things. And the cover picture of it is him having his epaulette stripped off, and he's like going, I'm innocent, and he's sort of like half lying on the ground, and you're like, oh, that poor man. And it's sort of the same thing, you know, just same thing that would happen to anybody else. All of a sudden, it's the...
Yeah, they're playing up the humiliation. Oh, how they're humiliating this man who hasn't done anything wrong.
And how could they be so mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, they're the bad ones, and he's the poor, innocent victim. Meanwhile, they've been putting together the whole plot to get him off, however long it takes. And his brother heads this, well, sort of, he's a figurehead.
Right, so it looks like his family, right.
Yeah, and his wife, his brother and his wife are trying to get him off. Of course, it's bankrolled by the Rothschilds largely, and it's said that about 30 million francs poured into France from outside the country, from Germany and England. Liebknecht says an interesting thing, which is that he spent time in prison reading, I think it was the Zola trial, which comes a little bit later, in which a lot of Dreyfus evidence was brought out in that. And he said what's amazing is how what they sent to the papers in the other country was totally at odds with what he was reading by reading the trial transcripts. He said they absolutely are not giving them the truth. I mean, even less than the people in France, because in France they had both kinds of papers, but the foreign papers... It was all the Dreyfusard side. So they had a big, big contingent of foreigners who hated the French because of this, the ones who believed it. So I wrote in this little précis that they'll use their usual means, infiltration of key government positions, domination of the media, recruitment of leftist academics and other intellectuals, bribery, threats, subornation of perjury, even murder. as this is right. Absolutely, this all went on. Monique, it's not, it doesn't, you know, it takes a while before it all really gathers steam. You know, that happens from the beginning of 1897 is when it'll really get going.
You know, I was thinking, Margaret, that the long period of time, and there's long periods between one event and another, they were really mm-hmm. taking their time. And that was a slower period of time. As we know, things mm-hmm. keep speeding up. And I suppose something like this happened today, it would be done in 6 months. But that was like 6 years or even longer than that.
It was 12 years before 12 they got
years.
Him declared innocent. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, of course, they're working behind the scenes. They're fermenting. It's not that easy because he really almost certainly was guilty. Though I will say that this Monique Delcroix does not go that far in the book I read, in her revisionist book, because she says friends of hers wanted her to, you know, come down on one side or another, but she wouldn't. Probably because, you know.
Afraid to do it, huh?
Yeah, okay. I would think she lives in
France. So her book wouldn't be banned.
Yeah, so she'd have a wider readership at any rate. So the next thing that happens, well, the first next thing that happens is that Santerre, the head of the statistical section, suddenly gets sick, and he really kind of thinks he's been poisoned, and so do other people. So he has to resign abruptly. And this man who was under him in the statistical section comes in, and this is Lieutenant Colonel Picard, Georges Picard. And he was one of the ones who helped convict Dreyfus. I mean, he was certainly involved in that, and apparently he had made some comments about him at his trial or degradation somewhere in there that didn't sound very friendly, but all of a sudden he seems to be on the Dreyfusard side, and he's being told by his superiors that he should now spend some time getting all the materials together that were used to convict Dreyfus and make sure that they're all in good order, in case, because they know they've been threatened and they've gotten some signals of what's coming along. And instead of doing that, Picard suddenly starts looking for somebody else. He starts looking for somebody whose name starts with a D. He has several people surveilled whose name starts with D, because there are a couple of telegrams or letters from Panizzardi to Schwarzkoppen. That's the Italian military attaché to the German, which mention someone named D. They say, that scoundrel D has brought me some information you might be interested in. So he's looking for somebody named D, but that doesn't pan out. And then it turns out, just by coincidence, that he settles on this man named Esterhazy, who's this French-Hungarian officer who's very very money hungry all the time. He always needs money, and he's been getting a lot of money from the Jews. He had a lot of connections with the Jews. He was like a second in some duels that were fought between some Jews and Edouard Trumont, who ran the anti-Semitic newspaper Libre Parole. There were several duels between Jews and non-Jews in the early 90s, and he was a second for the Jews in those. So he's got these connections, and he gets money from Zadok Khan, the head rabbi of France. He gets money from Rothschild. And all of a sudden, here he pops up. Captain Picard changes the regulations suddenly at the Office of Statistics and says, now I'm going to get the contents of the wastebasket first, instead of Henri gets them and puts them together. So once he came into office, it was turned around. So suddenly he comes up with this thing that they call the petit bleu. It's a little blue telegram letter. I guess it comes by telegram and then it's written down or something like that. It's on blue paper is how they come. So it's called the petit bleu. which is supposedly from Schwarzkoppen to Panizzardi, not to Panizzardi, to Esterhazy, talking about information that Esterhazy has given him. But the thing is, nobody in the office believes it, because it just is, they just don't trust him for several reasons.
Believe that he wrote that this
letter came from the way.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, well, for one thing, Henri wasn't giving him the things from the wastebasket right away. He decided he'd look through them first and then give them to Picard, and he hadn't seen any blue pieces of paper in it.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one thing, and also he was being kind of funny about it. It was as if he changed his mind and was thinking maybe he should have it come from somewhere else, because he was asking one of the guys, can you photograph it so there are no tear marks on it? And then he was asking somebody else, do you think we could put a stamp on it? And he said, you can swear this came from Schwarzkoppen, that is his handwriting, can't you? And Laut, this is a guy named L-A-U-T-H, German name, he said, no, I can't swear it's Schwarzkoppen's handwriting. First of all, it's not. So they were kind of suspicious of him.
Mm-hmm.
And then they
thought, now here's this thing with the sand here, which I'm sure you were going to go into, but I can't wait. So, the head of the BDR to suddenly fall ill, and then this other guy takes his place, Picard. And Picard turns out to be somebody who's involved in the whole,
he obviously, everybody notices that he's not doing the job he was.
And this is typical of how they operate. They get rid of the person who's mm-hmm. not going to work
with
them.
Yeah, whatever it takes.
And put somebody else in his place who will. And
exactly.
This poor Sandhair, he ended up dying, but it was a slow death.
Yeah, not right away. Yeah, it was slow.
Right.
But he definitely said that he thought he'd been poisoned. And he was in full health before this happened. And then suddenly Picard comes in.
Yes. Picard is full of intrigues and strange stuff he's doing. Okay.
Yeah, and there's another incident where Picard keeps getting this guy named LeBlois to come to the office, and LeBlois is definitely a Dreyfusard. He's a lawyer who's totally in with them and working with them. And several times they come into the office, and Henri comes in, and a guy named Gribelin, who's the archivist. Separate times they walk in, and the secret dossier is on the table between Picard and LeBlois, sitting there. In one case, it was just open, but nothing was out of it. But when Henri walked in, this secret telegram, the one that said, or not telegram, but the letter from Panizzardi that says, or to Panizzardi, where he says, this scoundrel D has brought me some information. This was right out, sticking out of the envelope, and it's right between them. And he's absolutely, first of all, he shouldn't even have LeBlois in the office. That's absolutely against the rules. And second of all, he just has a piece of a secret file. This file was not even shown to the defense in Dreyfus's trial. It was only shown to the jurors. And that's going to get the general staff in trouble later, because everybody says, they used a secret file, they used a secret file. Well, they always use a secret file in trials of espionage. Liebknecht mentions that. He said that's what they do. And in this case, there were many reasons to use a secret file, to keep it secret. One was that this guy, Val Carlos, his notes were in that secret file because he's a diplomat and working for them, basically, as an agent in terms of giving them secret information. And they don't want to bring it out in the open. Then another thing is that these letters between Schwarzkoppen and Panizzardi, these guys are homosexual lovers. And the way they write to each other, they're writing, Dear Bugger. And then they sign it, Don't Bugger Too Much.
Right. Or Schwarzkoppen and who? Who was the other guy?
And Panizzardi, the Italian.
Oh, the German and the Italian?
Yeah, they're having an affair. It's like quite obvious by the way they write to each other. So are they supposed to like give this to the defense? Everything's being leaked anyway all the time. You know, I mean, things are bad enough just that now it's out that they are somehow getting this information that the Germans are spying on the French, and you're supposed to pretend that's not happening. You know, it almost brings them to the brink of war at some point. So anyway, they had good reason to have this secret file. But so now here's this secret file. It's on the table between Picard and Lebrun, this Dreyfusard. They're no doubt talking about how they can substitute somebody. But Henri tells General Gans, who's the one right over him, the subhead of the general staff, what he just saw, and suggests he maybe get the secret file away from Picard. And they end up sending Picard to Tunisia because they think maybe it's better if he's just not around at all. The Dreyfusard version of this is that they're hoping he'll get killed in Tunisia or something. Once again, an example of how they project on others the kind of things they might do.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, the Picard hands in his file that he's gotten on Esterhazy. He's got the Petit Bleu. So before he goes, he's handed this in, and nobody thinks much of it. And he's gone around asking people, hey, do you think Esterhazy's handwriting looks like the handwriting on the bordereau? And the people are most like, no. Bertillon, who's one of the main handwriting experts for the Dreyfus case, said, well, it looks to me as if somebody's been learning to imitate Dreyfus's handwriting.
Mm-hmm.
which is probably the truth. Mm-hmm. So Esterhazy comes into the picture now, and because at this point, so Picard's in Tunisia, he's tried to get his superiors interested in Esterhazy, and they're saying, we're not very interested. They start an inquiry because they need to do that, but they don't. He has no access to the information, so it just doesn't pan out in terms of implicating him in anything. He didn't have the information. Now, later on, you'll see if you look at things written today about it, or starting with, way back with the Dreyfusards, is that they'll say that Esterhazy had information. Oh, and that Esterhazy met Schwarzkopf at this time and at this time and this time. You're like, how the hell would they know that? And it turns out Schwarzkopf later wrote a book in the early 1900s called The Notebooks of Schwarzkopf, where he talks about meeting Esterhazy all the time. It bears no resemblance to reality. It's just obviously he was supposed to write that book.
Well, why was he involved in it? He was a German, right?
Yeah, he
was
a German.
Why was he doing
that? Well, he was retired by them. I would guess they probably paid him to do it.
Oh, this guy was not too good. This guy was, homosexuals.
Okay. Yeah, it's interesting. One of the reasons that Liebknecht says that he was sure that Dreyfus was not innocent was that he said he had knowledge of the world of spying. He'd actually, you know, had some experience in terms of judging cases. And he said, if somebody is innocent, there's a code of honor. They will tell you he's innocent. He said, if they're guilty, they won't say anything. They won't come to your rescue. They'll tell you ahead of time that they won't come to your rescue. You're just on your own if you're caught. But if you're innocent, they actually will make an official denial that they've ever gotten anything from you. And he said, the German government never denied officially receiving anything from Dreyfus. They just made general denials where they said, oh, we wouldn't do that. We don't spy. You know, that means absolutely nothing.
Right.
So Esterhazy comes into the picture now as a replacement for Dreyfus. And because they know that the only way to get Dreyfus off is to have somebody to put in his place. So with Picard gone now, what happens is that Mathieu Dreyfus writes a letter to the, president, saying that he's found out that Esterhazy is guilty, and that his handwriting is just like the bordereau, because just by a strange coincidence, the bordereau showed up in the newspaper. The facsimile of it, so everybody could see the bordereau. So he says, I was just, this man, Castro, was looking at a photograph of the bordereau in a window, because I put it on a poster. And he said, wow, that looks just like this man, Esterhazy. And so he told me that it was like Esterhazy's writing, and so now I'm telling you that Esterhazy's the real spy. And it just gets so complicated, but mainly they just make up something and they produce some evidence, and so now
this bordereau is that image of a page something in French
with the itemized
tape
list.
All over it, but
it was taped together, and you can see it on the internet. Mm-hmm. A picture of it.
Yeah, I've got a picture of it on the slideshow for the show.
Oh, yeah. Oh, good.
Okay.
Well, if you look at it, you'll see a funny little niche in one side, a little bit of a place where it looks as if it was cut. And I didn't think anything of it at the time that I saw it first. But it turns out later that becomes important, because one of the handwriting experts says that paper found at Dreyfus's house has a matching little notch. That's the word I'm thinking of, which is a very strange coincidence. You know, if he hadn't written one.
What would the notch come from? And why would it be notched everything?
Well, what I read somewhere. There's a book called Le Rodin de Monsieur Bertillon, which I can't get because it doesn't seem to be available online. But I read somebody writing about it, and they're saying that this notch, when you send a spy letter often, you need a way to identify it, that it's actually coming from the spy that it's supposed to be coming from. And so you have something that you fit this notch in, and it matches.
Oh.
Because it is strange when you look at it, you know, well, you think maybe it's just torn up there, and that was torn off. But this actually, it apparently matches another letter that they found at Rachel's house.
Ah.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. Well, anyway, so here we are with this letter saying that Esterhazy is the real one. But meanwhile, they've been doing an investigation already at the statistics office, and they're like, no way, he couldn't have done it. But they're a little concerned about him. They know that Dreyfusards are going to be pushing him. So unfortunately, Dupaty and Henri decide that they should warn him. Now, the question is whether they were given orders to do that or not. But however, because later on, General Gans denies that he gave them orders about it. But at any rate, they decide they're going to warn him, so they start meeting with him. Now, that gives him a really good chance to make the most of that and pretend that they were working with him all along. And that will come along later, and it'll get them both in trouble.
And then this Esterhazy, though, he's going along with him being charged as the traitor. He's going along
exactly.
With that.
Exactly. They think that he's being framed, but he's not being framed. He's in collusion with them, with the Jews. He's being paid. And so so he's just playing along, and they look into it, and they decide they're going to drop the case. There's no case against him. And he says, I demand a court-martial. I demand to have my name cleared. So then they have a court-martial, and they acquit him. And then Monique Delcroix says, which is absolutely right, now it's great. Everything is fine. Now he can confess to the whole thing. And it's a double jeopardy. They can't do anything to him. But he does take the precaution of running off to England before he does it. he will do it, but not till he's safely in another country. Because they're thinking of pulling him up on some other charges, some morals charges. But meanwhile, the day after they acquit Esterhazy, Zola comes out with his J'accuse. And that makes a big tumult. Yeah, I accuse, and he accuses everybody of everything. They're anti-Semitic, and they've got a conspiracy to convict an innocent man, and I accuse this one, and I accuse that one, and they deliberately let Esterhazy off. And so they bring a defamation suit against him, which they win easily because it
against
was all
false.
Against Zola.
Who brings
the army?
The army does?
The army does.
Okay.
Yeah, they say he's defamed them, which he has.
Mm-hmm.
But a lot of the interesting information comes out in that trial because they sort of retry the Dreyfus case to some extent. And also stuff about Picard comes out. And one thing that's interesting is that this isn't, it's like, I wrote this in a white hot heat and then, you know, I was inspired and then, you know, and then everybody wanted to buy it. No, you know, they prepared the way. They put out posters the day before that this great article was going to come out. They printed 300,000 copies of it. They were preparing this publicity coup. And they did approach several authors before they approached Zola, who refused to do it. And, in fact, Zola apparently refused to do it at first, and then somehow he was brought around. Meanwhile, this guy named Bernard Lazare, this was earlier, wrote this thing called Judicial Error. And he's just this poor anarchist. I mean, he had been just this poor anarchist till the Dreyfusards get hold of him. And then he's got plenty of money, and so he can spend all his time writing about the Dreyfus case.
He became important. And was paid attention to. And I find it, I don't understand the society where someone who's an indigent Jewish anarchist and very poor suddenly is taken seriously in what he says, and he's like he's supposed to be some big intellectual now and respectable.
Yeah, well, see, I mean, obviously a huge amount of the media was in the hands of the Dreyfusards, and so they publish him. And according to what I read is he got to keep a quarter of the donations that went through his hands to people to win them to the Dreyfusard side. So he managed to collect money, I guess. Yeah, mm-hmm. Donations, lots of donations. And, I mean, they had all kinds of subscriptions. Jewish rabbis would collect money for it, and the Rothschilds would give money. And, you know, on all levels, they got money. And So they have the Zola trial, and what's interesting is that he was immediately just found guilty because this was not a military trial or anything. This was just a trial of the people. And most of the people really didn't like him to begin with. They considered him a pornographic novelist, and they didn't like him coming along and saying that the army was a bunch of criminal conspirators, you know, and they were all, a lot of them, anti-Semitic themselves anyway. So they
didn't Zola
see anything wrong with that.
Is Jewish, right?
No, I don't think so. He was Italian. I mean, who knows what was in the mix. But I'm just saying that he was accusing people of being anti-Semitic, I believe, in his J'accuse. Mm-hmm. Some people say that that J'accuse was actually written or dictated by Bernard Lazare. It certainly, you know, it just is not a good piece of writing. It's just, I mean, I don't know if you took the trouble to read it. I didn't read it very carefully because I just, like, this is trash, you know. It's just not that good. You know what's interesting is some people, I read a letter a year or two ago from Chekhov, he was just almost ready to die by then, and he's traveling in Italy, and he's reading Jacques Hughes, and he says, "Wow, I really admire that. You know, it's the first thing of Zola's that I really admire." And he says, "Even if he's not innocent, I still admire this." And I think, what a crock, you know, you should be smarter than that. If he's guilty, mm-hmm. what's so great about it? And if he's not, it's still, this is still trash writing, you know.
So the idea is that Zola was a famous writer and is considered a great writer. And so this thing that this Jacques Hughes is not up to that level. And that's why a lot of people really do think it was written by this Lazare, the ex-anarchist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the last part of it is like, "I know you're going to try me for what I said. You know, just go ahead and take me to court." But then when they find him guilty, he runs off to England. So I guess he didn't really want to stand by his words that much. I mean, I think if you're going to do that.
But this made such a big splash. I mean, this is so famous, mm-hmm. the Zola Jacques.
I know. You know, I think it's part of the corruption of taste, you know, that people will think this is so great just because why?
Because it was played up, probably, like you've been saying in the press. People will believe anything that the press tells them is important.
Yeah, and because it's standing up for the right people, you know, against the right wrong people, you know, against the not horrible whites, basically.
Mm-hmm.
The Jewish victim of the establishment elite.
Well, you know, there was I'll just stick in right here to keep people seeing the big picture. There was supposedly, I don't know, that's what they say now, the Jews do, you know, the Jew controlled information about this. There was so much anti-Semitism amongst the French. Oh, they're so bad. And that this what happened here brought that out, and the French are all ashamed of it, and changed the whole picture of how they were seeing. I thought I had something else to say there, but slipped my mind, something more than that to say. But this is the whole thing, that this is the whole, all comes down to anti-Semitism today, and how how France was just turned around and all those anti-Semites kind of started disappearing.
Yeah, that's the thing. It became, you know, before that it was okay to be anti-Semitic. It was just like you could be anti-Semitic or not, and that was just how you felt, which is basically how it should be. People's thoughts should be Gedanken sind frei, you know, but no more. You know, there's thought crime. You think the wrong things about the wrong people, and it's a crime. Yeah, I was about to say something, too, and I forgot, but...
Okay, sorry.
No, that's okay. It was just me. I got a little off on the
You were starting something there. But if Picard's shady tactics, no.
But what happened is there now that now Zola's in England, now Esterhazy's acquitted. Esterhazy runs off to England. Well, he doesn't quite yet. Then what happens is that the Dreyfusards have been looking for this fait nouveau to open the appeal against the first verdict, because that's what the law says, that if you have a fait nouveau, then you can appeal against the old verdict. Of course, then once you appeal, if the old verdict overturned, the person will have to go back to trial. So they just go ahead and they're going to... Oh, actually, before this happens, there's the faux Henri, and this is a really sort of sad episode. The Dreyfusards are really working to get this revision going, and the people in the general staff are really against it because they can see what's happening, that they actually are going to be bringing down the Office of Statistics, which is what happens. I mean, they're vengeful people. And So they're saying, oh, well, there's no real proof about Dreyfus. There's no real proof that it was Dreyfus. It just these secret files, which you should never have used anyway, just say D. They don't say Dreyfus. So suddenly Henri comes up with this letter he says he got from the from Madame Bastien's wastebasket, and paper bag, that says Dreyfus. It says it's supposed to be from Panizzardi saying to Schwarzkoppen, if they ask you if you know anything about Dreyfus, say that you don't, because we don't want anybody to know we had anything to do with him. So that seems like really cut and dried. And several people use it. I think somebody uses it at the Zola trial, and then the Minister of War, the new Minister of War, uses it to just shut people up. Look, it says Dreyfus, so shut up. So, but Monique Delcroix points out the Dreyfusards seem to know from the very beginning that this is a fake. And it is a fake. They find out, somebody in the General Staff Office finds out, he can see in a certain light that there's a different tint. These French papers often have a little bit of a plaid, sort of a checked pattern. And one of the pieces of paper that was used on this, it has a little bit of a blue tint, and one had a little bit of a pink tint, if it was under lamplight, but not if it was under daylight. So then they see that, and then they confront Henri, and they say, what's going on? And he says, well, it was mostly true. I mean, he sort of doesn't know what to say, and he doesn't put up a very good defense. And he finally says, they say, well, were you alone in this? And he says, yes, but he sort of hesitates first. And anyway, so then he finally says, yes, I did it. And then they arrest him.
So he wrote this false letter, but
I think it's not at all certain. I don't think it's certain that he did. You know, people seem to, a lot of people seem to think it's certain he did. But other people, for example, Mathieu Dreyfus said before that this man, another man wrote it named Le Mercier Picard, whose real name was Moisey Lehmann, a Jewish con man and forger, that he had written it. And before Henri was arrested, a couple of months before, this man was found hanging from his window frame in his hotel. So now he's dead. He can't say anything. And I'm sure the Dreyfusards weren't expecting this forgery to come to light when it did, because it happened, actually, Henri's own people found it. And they figured they had to follow it up, even though it was bad for them. And it was very bad for them. A lot of people at that point became Dreyfusards because they figured that they... Mm-hmm. General staff was full of forgers. But,
well, why didn't Henri say that he didn't, if he didn't?
Did it?
I was kind of under the impression that he admitted it.
Yeah, well, number
and
one,
and that he actually did
it.
Do it.
Hmm? Yeah, I think it may be that he was handed it, and maybe that he added something else to what he was handed. He said several different things. One was that he just added the last line to make it more emphatic. You know, another thing to know is that people do this all the time. I don't know if you've noticed, but in World War II, you look at the diplomatic things, records, and you're like, wow. You know, I mean, they're just, people wrote all kinds of things that didn't really reflect what went on. But I'm suspecting there is something to do probably with this layman. Maybe somebody... Because several people who write about it say that Lehmann forged it under Henry's direction. But when they say that, they're saying that Lehmann worked for the statistical section, which he didn't. I think it's pretty clear that he absolutely never worked for them. I think it's more likely that Lehmann was put up to it by the Dreyfusards. I think that Henry was entrapped one way or another. I don't know if he... I also suspect that because of the fact people say, I don't know why he put these two different letters together when he could have done it with just one, and then it wouldn't have been found out. And so that sounds sort of as if it was a poison pill that was put in there. So I'm not at all sure one way or the other, because what happened is that they never really interrogated him. As soon as he said we, they ended the interview, and he was locked up. in Mont Valérien, and he was found the next evening with his throat cut. It sure doesn't look that much like suicide to me, because they say, number one, his throat was cut from both sides with 6 or 8 cuts in all. So that means using both hands. His razor was folded up in his left hand. He's right-handed. So that's a kind of strange suicide. He also had written before that to General Gans, his superior, the general staff underhead. He said that it was very important for him to come and see him. So he had something to tell him. So that I question whether he would kill himself if he had something he thought was important to tell him. But you never know, you know.
Well, I think it sounds like he was murdered. But the thing is, would have access to his prison cell that he was in? Where was he being held?
He was being held at a place called Mont Valérien. I think it wasn't as much of a prison as Cherche Midi, where Dreyfus was held, but it was still a prison. But somebody, I don't know where this information comes from. I've read that there was a mysterious visitor to him the night before.
Oh, that's right. Right. I read that.
And somebody wrote that he drank a bottle of rum. Well, if the rum was spiked, you know. And his last letter, he wrote a letter to his wife where he said, you know that I've been honorable. You know who I've always worked for, which he means his country and the military. And you know that if there was anything in there that was not genuine, it was from things that I had been told or given that I didn't have. So he was saying, none of this is untrue. It's just I put some things together. But then he wrote another letter to her where he says, my brain is burning. I'm going to go take a bath in the Seine. So it could be that he was drugged and then his throat was cut, because at that point it sounded as if he might have been drugged.
I'm sticking with that. That's what I think. I think they murdered him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so I think it's pretty clear that. And Monique Dacroix talks about whether it might have been something rotten in the general staff, because she says, why didn't they question him? Why didn't they interrogate him after they arrested him? Well, I just don't think so. I don't agree, because the fact is, I think everybody was pretty knocked out by this. This is their own man. They've just charged with this, and they don't know he's going to be murdered or commit suicide. Mm-hmm. They think they'll be able to interrogate him the next day or the day after. Mm-hmm. They left Dreyfus for 2 days before they interrogated him officially. So, I think whatever came to him is much more likely to have come from the Dreyfusard side. And I think that means they were mixed in it. And Delcroix says clearly that if they knew that was a forgery from the beginning, they obviously know because they did it.
And I think this Monique, whose book you like, but you're saying, mm-hmm. That she's bending over backwards to appear mm-hmm. objective and fair and so on. So any little thing mm-hmm. like that, she plays up, and she's not going to say what she might really think.
Yeah, at the very first, she gives sort of a very quick précis of Dreyfus's arrest and stuff. And then right after that, she says, I know that what I've just said may sound partial, because she's just given an objective account. And she hasn't said, the anti-Semites did this and blah, blah, blah. And she's very aware that just to simply put down the facts sounds as if you're on the wrong side already. So now Henri's dead. And immediately what happens is they start putting everything on him, that he's colluded with Esterhazy, and Esterhazy was working for him, and he's done all these forgeries, and it's really too bad, And the principal historian, who almost everybody goes to, well, I guess everybody goes to when they write about Dreyfus, is Joseph Reinach, who's Jewish, of course, and he's actually a nephew of somebody involved in the Panama affair, which was a very anti-Semitism-causing disruption that happened in the end of the 1880s. So right. He comes from a long line of disruptors. And he's writing the history, like the official history of this, at the same time that he's pretty much running this Dreyfusard campaign. So he immediately, Henri's hardly cold in his grave when he starts being absolutely smeared by Joseph Reinach. And his widow brings suit against Reinach.
What's the name of this Reinach's book that's so considered the,
Histoire de l'affaire Dreyfus, History of the Dreyfus Affair. And it's like in 7 or 11 volumes or something. He's just writing it all the way along. And everybody goes to it. And all, if you read it, all it is like, oh, this guy was horrible and this guy was, you know, he just says absolutely unverifiable things about these people. Oh, here's a description of... maybe I can't find it, of Mercier, who was the minister of war, who decided to go ahead and prosecute Dreyfus. This is Reinach's description of him. It says he made decisions on everything. He was dry, haughty, provokingly smug, infallible, and sure of his star. He says, everything, anyway, that's the main thing, that he's just totally haughty and sure of himself, and he's got the insolence of a parvenu, of a, what do you call it, nouveau riche, which he wasn't anyway, but so he just throws these terms around.
Yeah,
because
insult.
He's sort of,
just insult.
Yeah, he just, and where does he get this, you know? Anyway, so that's the one who wrote the history. It's just vilifying anybody involved with prosecuting Dreyfus. So he does that to Henri right away, and Henri's widow, Henri was just 52 when this happened. So at the beginning of the affair, this is 98. In 94, he was just 48, and he had a 20-year-old wife. At this point, he's got a 4-year-old son and a 24-year-old wife, and of course, patriots feel really bad for her, and she starts a lawsuit against Reinach. And I think there's got to be some very interesting information in that. And she does describe, she describes this later in a later trial about Henri putting together the bordereau on the dining room table. He pastes together the thing that brought Dreyfus down. But okay, so now Henri's dead, and Esterhazy. Right after that is when Esterhazy runs off to England, and they are trying to do the get the appeal passed. They have this committee that allows you to appeal the verdict, and they've brought these faits nouveaux, including the faux Henri, the Henry forgery, saying this is a reason to open it. And the court says no. I mean, the commission says no, it's not, because Dreyfus was, you know, condemned 4 years ago, and this fact has nothing to do with it. And just then, from England, Esterhazy puts a big article in a magazine saying, "I wrote the bordereau, but the general staff told me to do it."
Oh boy!
So then the commission reconvenes, and they. And they say, okay, we'll do the appeal. Yeah, we've approved the appeal.
So he's confessing to the crime now that he's already been found. He's already
innocent of.
Now he's over in England confessing to the crime.
Yeah, but what's funny also is that the day after they vote to have the appeal, then he says, "Oh no, I didn't do it." And he sues the magazine or something, or gets damages from the magazine for publishing his story. I don't know. He gets it coming and going. He's actually amazing character. I mean, just what a liar. And what a player.
And is he Jewish? Esterhazy? He's Hungarian.
No, he's not. He's Hungarian. Yeah.
Okay.
There's some interesting descriptions of him as a soldier of fortune. He just was all over the place. He was in disgrace for a while. He was in the Foreign Legion. He was worked under various flags. He wrote a famous letter that was, he probably wrote this deliberately to smear himself and then complain about it. I don't know, where he was saying that he'd die happy if he could be in the midst of a bloodbath where they were killing French or something like that.
Wow.
So now it's time to have the appeals court, and they have the appeal, and they say, yes, Esterhazy did it. Dreyfus didn't do it, so we're going to hand it over to the court-martial again, so he'll be found innocent. So they bring back Dreyfus from Devil's Island, and meanwhile, all this time, they've been writing these tear-jerking things about how miserable he is on Devil's Island, and, you know, et cetera. They're shocked to see that he's not totally a wreck. He's kind of thin, but he comes back for the trial. So he's brought back for the trial, and they have the trial in Rennes, the town of Rennes, and everybody thinks he's going to be cleared now, but then people start giving evidence, and I've read some various accounts from, like, English people went over there thinking that it was going to be a slam dunk and he'd be cleared, and they start seeing some of the evidence against him, and they're like, huh? What's happening here? Because, of course, they've read only the very slanted things, but actually there's very strong evidence against him, and he's condemned again. So for a second time, he's just been found guilty.
In spite of what Esterhazy has said, so they're not believing Esterhazy's statement.
No, there's just, he couldn't have gotten the information. It just doesn't pan out.
Mm-hmm.
He didn't have access to it. You know, they try to come up with these ways that he could have, but really he couldn't have.
You know, and police work, they say they understand how common false confessions are.
Mm-hmm.
So they don't just immediately say, oh, this guy confessed, okay, you know, he must be the one. Go ahead. I'm done.
You also don't say, well, this guy keeps saying he's innocent, so he must be. That's what some of the people who write about Dreyfus say. He never stopped proclaiming his innocence.
Yeah,
you know,
right.
Well,
they
big
do.
Deal.
Like, that means something. Yeah.
Yeah. DFD, yeah. Yeah. Okay. Anyway, so he's found guilty again, but this time it's just 5-2 rather than unanimous. And the big thing is that they find him innocent guilty with extenuating circumstances. Monique Delcroix says she thinks that maybe that means that some people had some doubts. That was their way of saying they had some doubts. I don't think so. The defense, his defense at the end was reduced to just begging for people to pay attention to any possible doubt, because the case had really been, it was a very strong case against him. So his defense is saying, you know, if there's any reasonable doubt, you have to not convict. But then the prosecutor got up and said, if you are convinced in your hearts that he's guilty, you can vote guilty. And I guess 5 out of 7 were. But the reason they voted the extenuating circumstances, Liebknecht talks about that, and he says it wasn't out of doubt. It was because probably they felt sorry for him, and they thought he'd suffered enough, and this way they can give him just 10 years, and then he can get a pardon, and it's all over. They're not worried about him stealing secrets anymore. But what I think also is that at that point, the Jews were threatening an international boycott of the Universal Paris Exposition, which was going to open the next year. So it would be very bad publicity to send him away for life. So I think there are various extenuating circumstances.
So when they're saying that out in the open, threatening that if Dreyfus was found guilty in the same way, that they were going to boycott this thing. Were they saying that out in the open?
Yeah, there would be. They would arrange an international boycott.
Wow. You know, that's what is that? That's a blackmail or something.
Chutzpah.
Well, they get away with this kind of thing. Nobody else does.
That's right. And it's like what Zadok Khan said. You think we can't do it? We can.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
I don't know how they do it.
So the next day, Esther Dreyfus is pardoned. So
that was the next day he's pardoned after they signed him guilty again, 5-2.
Which nobody minds. I mean, I think in a way, I mean, nobody cares about the pardon. They just, because, I mean, okay, he's been on Devil's Island. He's going to come back and live his life. But that's not enough for the Dreyfus Arts. They want him found innocent. I mean, a pardon is one thing, but declaring somebody innocent is something else. But the thing is, you know, they can work towards another appeal. But if they send him back for another court-martial, he'd be found guilty again because the evidence is there. And that's an interesting thing also in the Delcroix book. She talks about that the dossier is kind of thin and that she doesn't think he would be found guilty in a court of law today. And I mentioned that to you before. This is a court-martial. It's not a regular court of law. Also, if you see how fast Zola was found guilty, you see, a jury might find him guilty very fast. Because, anyway, you can't predict, but definitely when you see all the witnesses' testimony on top of the dossier, then you see, you know, it would be easy to find him guilty. I would, just reading all the stuff I've read, I think I would have found him guilty. And another thing Delcroix says is that she thinks that the military relied too much on its own authority. But what they're talking about when you say their own authority is that they actually have been present, for instance, at the dictation when he started writing funny, when they said the words of the bordereau, or they saw his, you know, they hear him lie again and again when he's answering questions, which he did at Rennes. He would lie until he couldn't get away with it anymore, and then he'd say, okay. You know, and that doesn't make a good impression. So anyway, so it's time to get this new appeal going. And the first thing they do is they demolish the Office of Statistics, which they said they were going to do and which the statistical section had feared. They basically dismantled it. And they put part of it, they put the counter-espionage part underneath the new Minister of the Interior rather than the Minister of War. And that's because it was a man named Waldeck Rousseau who was a very discreet Dreyfusard. And so then what they do is they have somebody who is a Dreyfusard go into the office and go through all the files to find something they can use for a new fact, a fait nouveau, to have a new appeal. And so he just goes through, and it looks as if he actually probably altered some things.
Who's he and now? Who's he?
His name is Targe. It's just somebody that they've got working for them named Targe, and I don't know that much about him right now, I mean, so far. But he just brings a list of all these things he's found wrong. There's a paper that has a date on it that he thinks Henri put on it, which was not the right date. And General Gons, who's shown that paper, first of all, it has nothing to do with Dreyfus, so who cares? But the other thing, General Gons says, I'd like a handwriting analysis on that because I didn't see that date on there before. And they refuse. So, I mean, they could fiddle with those documents as much as they want. So they have it's called a cassation, their appeals trial. And this is a very slow process. First, they dismantle the Office of Statistics and start the search. And the other thing they do, which is that they declare this amnesty law that any court actions that are going on that have to do with Dreyfus will now be just disappear because it's an amnesty and because we want everybody to be friends now. But the way it is that the only people now who are in, you know, waiting to be tried on these things are Dreyfusards. Picard is being tried for his for the Petit Bleu and other infractions, and Reinach is has a court action against him by the widow of Henri, and let's see, what's the other one? Oh, Zola has an appeal that he's going to lose, no doubt, if it goes to trial. So these three just are wiped off.
Huh.
No more.
Yeah,
and
nice.
The thing is, yeah, these would also, if these people were found guilty, you know, that would affect the outcome, perhaps, of the appeals court. You know, if you find mm-hmm. that Reinach has been lying about Henri, then they can't really say the same things about Henri at the appeals court that Reinach was saying, et cetera. So, anyway, so that's out of the way. And then they take these Fait Nouveau and they go to the cassation court and they set aside the 1899 trial, the Rennes trial verdict. But they have to do this so that he won't have to go back to trial. And by law, he has to go back to trial.
It's now 1904, right?
Something 1904 like to 1906. By the time the verdict is read, it's 1906, 12
wow.
years after the. And okay. But by now, Dreyfus has been free for 5 years. So that's, you know, it's okay for him. I don't think he would have cared all that much. I mean, he's like,
so
I really
he's
want
back
to be
in,
serious,
is he in Paris or wherever he is, living with his wife?
Yeah, I think so. I think
again.
So, yeah. Yeah, and he's been
reinstated
in the army. And
yeah,
he's been given the Legion of Honor. No, later he'll be given the Legion of Honor after he's found innocent. But
yeah.
He's back in the army, I think.
Oh, he's back in the army. They had.
I'm not sure
back.
If he is or if that has to wait till he's declared innocent. I'm not sure. But anyway, he's with his wife. He's living comfortably. But
mm-hmm.
So the way they do this, first of all, they declare, which they don't have the authority to do, that Esterhazy was guilty of the bordereau and that treason. They have no standing to do that. They can only say that the last court's finding was wrong. But they do this because then they also say, they're not allowed to say that Dreyfus is innocent, but they do. And what they do is they say there's Article 445 tells you the conditions in which you can not remand somebody for trial. And there are two conditions. One is that he's dead, so then you don't have to. And then the other one is if there's the crime doesn't exist anymore, which he was accused of, if in your findings you found that there was no crime. Well, they haven't found that there was no crime. There still was that treason. But
mm-hmm.
that's what the law says. But they got around it by writing the law differently from how it was. In their announcement, they don't write the law as it was. And mostly when you read it, I mean, I haven't read a single modern source that actually puts the law as it was. They just write it the way this court wrote it, which is falsified.
And now this is the military court still.
No, this is not the military court. This is the appeals court.
Oh, okay. And so they're completely
yes,
going
well,
along
government,
with
the government is controlled by now by the Dreyfusards.
Mm-hmm.
So this
mm-hmm.
is a government court, and it's all in the hands okay. of the Dreyfusards.
Yeah.
So there's
but
no doubt of the outcome.
Right.
It's just, how can they get him to not have to go to trial again? Because that'll be back with the military, and he will be found guilty again. And the only way they can do it, and this is another reason to think he's guilty, if the only way they can do it is by cheating, then something's wrong. But so what they do, they take this sentence that says, if nothing remains of the crime for which he was tried. Okay, so that's the sentence. If like they add three words, à sa charge, which means attributable to him. If nothing remains attributable to him of the crime that was blah blah. Well, this was not in the rule. They have no standing to decide if it was attributable to him or not. They just put that in. They put those words in. That crime is still there. That means he should still be tried for it.
Mm-hmm.
And they're so ashamed of this. I mean, or they know that they know they've done something wrong, so they don't even release this verdict till 1908. They don't release it in written form, so nobody knows what's gone on. They just declare, okay, Dreyfus is innocent. We've declared he's innocent. And he doesn't have to go back for retrial, so that's done.
So saying it was no, there was no crime committed by this person.
That's not the law.
That's supposed to mean that there's no crime, so they can just.
Yeah, if there was no crime committed, then yeah, the real law says if there was no crime committed, then
right.
He doesn't have to go for trial. Well, there was a crime committed, so they changed it to if there was no crime committed by this person. Then he doesn't
and
have
how
to
do they get
now,
away with that? Only in the way that these things are always gotten away by just pushing it through, and there's not enough people to object to it, or they don't have the power to do so anymore, and so on.
Yeah,
and we see this over and over again, and how these unpopular things get forced through that nobody wants.
Unpopular and illegal. I mean, how about Obama saying, okay, great, you don't kick the illegals out, you know, 5 million are welcome, you know, I just signed something and said it.
Yeah.
You know, if they can do it and they can get away with it, then they've done it. When people finally found out about it 2 years later, 1908, they were livid, and the Action Française put posters all over Paris about it, and I think probably other towns, posting that and saying they've used a falsification for this verdict, and we protest for what good that did. Since we're talking about the Action Française, I should mention about the fact that in your blurb about the show, you mentioned the ADL, Anti-Defamation League, and how that came up because of the Frank trial, the Leo Frank trial. Well, because of this Dreyfus trial, they started the Ligue des Droits de l'Homme, the League of Rights of Man. That sprang up through the Dreyfus arts in this case, and that's still very active, you know, prosecuting Holocaust deniers and everything, and on the watch for anti-Semitism all the time. And
of the American ADL, huh?
Exactly, yep.
Yes.
And that came about because of the Dreyfusards. And another thing that happened right at this time in 1906 was that they separated church and state definitively. The schools were no longer run by the churches, which meant that they could they could give their versions of history, like about the Dreyfus affair. And there was a very big scandal right after this, where one of the Dreyfusards had become minister of war. I better not talk now. I just realize that I don't remember exactly what I'm talking about. But there's something. It was a list scandal. He was dividing people into people who were Catholic and people who were not, and the people who were Catholic were out. And there was a big scandal about that, and he got kicked out. But that's the people who got in through this. Before I talk about the after effects, I would like to talk about this thing that happened in 1908, which I wrote to you about, which is, I think, a very important thing about what was thought about the case at that time compared to what is thought about the case these days, because people might think, you know, at this time that really France was divided in two. No, it wasn't divided in two. It was divided into a small, very powerful cadre, and then the rest of France, because most of France really supported their military and supported the Catholics and the conservatives and supported, law and order, basically. And they saw what was happening, and they called the Dreyfusards the syndicat, the syndicate. So here's what happened 2 years later. In 1908, they had decided, Zola had died meanwhile at the beginning of the 20th century and been buried wherever he was buried, and there were rumors that there was some foul play having to do with his death, but I think nobody knows. A chimney was stopped up or something. But they decided they were going to transfer his ashes to the Pantheon. And meanwhile, Dreyfus had been promoted, and, you know, reinstated, promoted, and given the Legion of Honor because he had suffered so much. And so he's, like, riding his horse and reviewing the troops, and they're taking Zola's ashes to the Pantheon. And this guy named Gregory, who was a military journalist, shoots Dreyfus in the arm twice with an 8-caliber pistol. It doesn't even break the skin, I guess, and gets taken to court for attempted murder.
How can they say he shot him in the arm if he doesn't even break the skin? Maybe the bullet went through his clothing?
It went through the sleeve, you know, and bounced off, basically.
Yeah.
He had contusions. Yeah, but he was charged with attempted murder. And he was kept in prison for a couple of months, and then they tried him. And he took the opportunity to make all these speeches, and the judge was very lenient about it, you know, because his defense was, it was like a crime of passion. You know, his lawyer said it's like a crime of passion. You do not convict a man if he finds his wife in bed with another man and kills them both. He will not be convicted because it was a crime of passion. And he says, this was a crime of passion, only it was political passion, not amorous passion. And so because of that, the judge gave him full leeway to expound his reasons why he had such a conviction that he had to shoot Dreyfus. And so he had all these witnesses called. And first of all, what happened is that all the Dreyfusard witnesses that he called just didn't show up. They just didn't bother to show up. Now, it's the law. They're supposed to show up, but they just didn't. Clemenceau and Reinach and various Dreyfusards, they were called, but they didn't show up. So, okay. So he's got his anti-Dreyfusard witnesses, and he wants to call them up and have them talk about Dreyfus stuff. And the judge won't let him because he says, we will not retry the Dreyfus affair. And he's like, but this, I want to show why I have my conviction, because otherwise they won't believe me, you know, they won't think I have a strong enough conviction, because what he wants is a revision of the revision. Revision of the appeals trial and have the anyway, so the judge won't really allow it. But he gives some good speeches, and one of the things he says, which is very interesting, is that perhaps 500,000 people in France, he says, are Dreyfusards and thought Dreyfus was innocent. And he said the other 38,500 believed Dreyfus was guilty.
Well, I've got here 39 million.
There were 39 million. 39 million in France. And he says that 500,000 maybe were Dreyfusards and 38,500. 38,500,000. Did I say that wrong before?
Okay. Yeah, you did.
38,500,000 were anti-Dreyfusards.
Okay.
And I guess you would judge by the public displays that could have been true, because there was a lot of booing and hissing before he shot Dreyfus, already at Dreyfus. Anyway, so he gives this speech, and that's very interesting to hear that. And he says this small elite is crushing the other people and, you know, not allowing them to have a voice, and they're just doing what they want, which is pretty much true, and kind of true today, too. And he also said they're going to get control of the schools, and they're going to teach it the way they want, and everybody's going to learn the wrong history. And he was very prescient in saying that.
Yes, very smart.
Mm-hmm. And so he had a few of his witnesses managed to get in a little bit of things about the Dreyfus case before the judge cut them off. And one was Duparty de Clam, who did the interrogation of Dreyfus. And he said something interesting, which was that he had recently found out that that even before the bordereau was found, the general staff was having Dreyfus surveilled. Well, yeah, I mean, I'd read other places they were a little suspicious of him, but I didn't realize they actually were, and it'd be interesting to know more about. But anyway, in the end, with this trial, the jury went to deliberate. They stayed out 20 minutes, and they came back, and they found him innocent on all charges. They had a choice of attempted murder or attempted bodily harm, and like, nope, innocent.
This so that's is how the Grigori, yeah, the guy who shot.
Yeah, Grigori, yep.
Dreyfus.
Yeah,
that's kind of surprising. Did that surprise everybody, or were they expecting that?
I think in that court they were expecting it. There was like a huge, huge applause at that point.
Yeah.
For several minutes, yeah. So definitely was mostly an anti-Dreyfusard court. The Dreyfusards in the audience were not happy. There was some booing and hissing in the corner. But, mm-hmm. Yeah, so that, I mean, but, you know, he really thought that might do something, having that trial. And I think basically it didn't do much, except there's still the record of that trial, and that's good. You know, the thing is that these records are online, and that's, if anybody can read French, just go in and start. You can go to the Bibliothèque Nationale, but a lot of them are also on archive.com. Just start putting in some of these terms, and you'll find all these trial transcripts are online. It's some of that testimony is just fascinating. You know, in overall, this case, to me, it seems as if it's kind of boring because they're just doing the same thing they always do. They swarm and they do all these dirty tricks and they get what they want. But when you look at the details are actually quite interesting. You never know what somebody's going to say. One thing, I was reading part of the appeal, the second appeals trial, and I stayed up till morning reading it because I just didn't know what these people were going to say. I sort of thought that Du Paty de Clam would defend Henry, Henri, you know, his dead comrade. But it turns out he starts kind of pushing things on Henri and saying, oh, I knew that was a forgery, and I think he knew I knew, and he was trying to send me on these missions to get me out of the way. I'm like, oh, they're turning on each other. And then his superior, Gonce, says, I didn't tell him they could meet Esterhazy. But then some even more interesting things come out because they find these, they're asking him about some things his office did. And there's this letter about Picard. Now, I had read that they were making homosexual allegations about Picard, but I guess it turns out it's true. He was actually called, his name was Georges Picard, and they called him Georgette. So no. Now you sort of, I was wondering what turned him around so fast, you know, from being very anti-Dreyfus to suddenly he comes in and starts looking for a replacement for Dreyfus and working for his innocence. So it may not just have been money, because it's not really, you know, it wasn't like today. So it's like, wow, I didn't know I was going to be reading that. So anyway, there's
so
very
interesting
testimony.
So it seems like
there's
a lot of homosexuals in the army then?
Or maybe I don't know, but definitely
these particular ones that were involved in espionage were.
Yeah, these three so far we've found, and they didn't seem to be too surprised about it. I had read that there were caricatures online of Picard dressed as a woman or something, and so I guess it was not such a big secret. But I just thought that was just a caricature because he has a slightly effeminate look to him, but then apparently it was real, at least real enough to be written in a letter. But anyway, so I encourage anybody who wants to look up some of this stuff. I want to say something maybe about this Madame Bastien. She was a courageous woman. She was a good woman. And this is an example of the Dreyfusard's kinds of activities, too. She, just in 1899, before the Rennes trial, a few months before, she quit her job at the embassy because she figured that she was going to be exposed, probably at the Rennes trial. And she started being followed by somebody, and he came into her house and was trying to persuade her to give false testimony at the Rennes trial. And she went in the kitchen and picked up a knife and chased him out. And then she went to a policeman and tried to have him arrested, and he found out that this guy was from the Sûreté, which was actually largely in the hands of the Dreyfusards, so he couldn't arrest him. But that, you know, she was a spunky woman, and she was a good woman. And I also, there was a statement made by Santerre, who was later poisoned. And I guess he might not have been poisoned if he had taken up this offer. Mathieu Dreyfus and somebody else came to him, and they said, we'll put our fortunes at your disposal if you'll change your mindset, you know, and make this go away. And he's like, no way. Next thing you know.
Oh, yeah, he might be the best hero of the whole thing.
Yeah,
they got him out
of
the way. Yeah, see, yep. You mentioned is Alfred Dreyfus's brother.
Brother.
And so they come and say, well, we're going to, you know, do this for us and we'll take care of you. And he said no. And most of these people don't do that, you know. They're boy. So that was somebody who they didn't want around. I'm sure they killed him. I think that's, now there's two murders there. Henri and Sandhair.
Yeah, no, and Lehmann, Moisey Lehmann found him.
Yes, that's right.
Frame,
that's right. Three.
There's another one who very likely may have been murdered. There was actually a sort of a semi-confession of Dreyfus right at the time of his degradation. I think he was maybe, it seems he was very emotional, a little hysterical sort of sometimes, a little volatile. And he made this sort of confession to this man who was with him, Lebrun Renault, who was conducting him, who wasn't really supposed to be speaking to him, so he wasn't encouraging it. But Dreyfus said, basically, well, if I did deliver secrets to the Germans, it wasn't important things, and it was to get better information. And so he's like, wow, that's interesting. And he reported it to his superiors and stuff. But there was another man who was walking past at that time and heard the whole thing. And so the next summer, this other man who heard the confession, and they both reported this to their superiors, this other man was just found dead in a railway carriage. Just nobody knew what happened to him. He just was in a railway carriage by himself. And when he got to the end of the line, he was dead. And it might or might not have anything to do with it. Monique Delcroix thinks that people are being very paranoid or whatever, just conspiracy-minded to think that. But once they have only one person talking about the confession who heard it directly, then it's not the same as having two people.
Right. And then this guy was found dead. Wow.
Yeah, just dead in the railway car.
Well, how would you sum up, what this means, or what we should get from this today? Or I mean, it's pretty obvious, but
my main thing is that I just think people should start getting this information out one way or another, because as I wrote to you 10 years ago, if you looked up the Gleiwitz incident, you saw nothing on the internet except the lie, just nothing. And I think it was 2006. I had an article in the Barnes Review, which was a translation of a chapter by Joaquin Bochaca from Crimes of the Good Guys, where he's talking about the Gleiwitz incident and that it was obviously not a false flag by the Germans. He had a very simple point to make, that if it had been, they would have had photographs. At least, you know, and they would have publicized it. But since there was nothing, obviously there was no false flag. But anyway, but then after that, and Birdman Bryant then put that on the internet, so it really got pretty wide distribution. And then I'm not sure when it was that you came out with your article, which was really good and very, very thorough. And now you look on Google and you put Gleiwitz incident, and yours is the third one down. And so many people, you know, I don't know how many people must have clicked on that by now. Can you tell, looking at your statistics?
Yeah, I've got the numbers on, is that one here? No, that one's not here.
But there, you
it's
know,
not
it could
on
be
my
also
list,
posted.
But
it could be posted also on other websites, because I've had things that I've had on there, like some of the articles that were translated,
yeah,
show up on
up
even
some of those articles like that of mine.
Yeah, so you can't even tell just by your statistics. A lot of people are educated in that, and so I'm just hoping that within a few years, maybe you won't see this blanket. There was one thing I started looking, because just about a year ago I started thinking, Dreyfus, was he really innocent? And I started looking on the web, and I couldn't find anything but that he was innocent. And then I found this one thing in French. It says, J'accuse Dreyfus. I accuse Dreyfus. And
yeah, good. Well,
website,
Right. Well, yeah, I just found this on the Gleiwitz false flag incident is pure fiction that I wrote. On my site, it's had 11,600 reads.
But it's third on Google, so that's interesting because you think there's been
well, it probably
more
gets, it's been picked up a lot.
Yeah, what I think. So, but even if people just read the headline when they click on it, it's going to make them think. So I found that one article. It's not even much of an article. It's got a little timeline, and it says the fact that he wasn't sent back to be tried again, which was illegal, means he was not found innocent, really. And then it gave the names of the titles of two books, which you can find online, which really tell the story. And so I just clicked on them, and luckily I can read French, so I could find out about it. But what we need, of course, is a lot of English.
Yeah, most everything is in French. It's kind of it's a real French thing. And
but even in French, that's the only thing I found that said he was guilty. And it's not even
the
whole article.
Right, I mean, it's across the board. It's like put out as though there's no question about it. Everybody says, oh, the Dreyfus affair was an anti-Semitic thing, blah, 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 and they just start out like that. And an innocent man was found guilty because he was a Jew, and on they go. There's never any other point of view that you see anywhere. And you said even on Metapedia, the article about Dreyfus,
exactly.
They have
it
him.
Picked up that Henry Macau article where it says, well, he was innocent, but it was a Rothschild plot.
They have a lot of people over there at Metapedia that like that Henry Macau type stuff, not just Henry Macau, but all that type of supposedly truth telling, and they promote that all the time. There's some
that's
people
so Jewish,
there
that kind of
it is.
Yeah.
It is. I mean, they should be.
The truth is the truth. You can't just like pick and choose.
Well, so I think it would be important to try to show another side of this because it's such a perfect thing they have there for proving that that we accuse Jews of things and we don't like Jews because of our anti-Semitism. No other reason. You know, this is the perfect example of it.
And the biggest revisionist thing is some people say, well, it wasn't really because of anti-Semitism, but they won't, you know, that's the biggest thing in the revisionism. They won't go to say, oh, actually he was guilty. They'll just say, well, he was innocent, but really there were other factors in play, you know, and they were, there are all kinds of
why do you think people don't want to go to the guilty thing? Do they think that it's just impossible and they'll just look foolish because
maybe Jewish publishing houses partly, who knows? But I mean, do they do this intentionally? I've got Piers Paul Reed's book, which is the most recent big book on it in English, the Dreyfus affair, the blah blah that split France in two, and you look in the back of it, the bibliography, he doesn't even have the two books in there that give the whole story about the evidence against him and stuff, and they're big important books, and they actually are in some libraries in the U.S. in French. You know, so they're not unknown books, but they're just not in there in the bibliography. Why can't he just read them?
I think this Dreyfus affair is really, really important and key for world Jewry, you know, in the way that they're involved in things like the Leo Frank case and all the other things they've done. Mm-hmm. I think this Dreyfus affair, that they can make Dreyfus innocent and wrongly accused and so on, is hugely important.
And they took over
They
took over the government. They took over the mindset of the country. Mm-hmm. They basically directly led to World War I because these people they put in power, like Poincaré and Clemenceau, those were both Dreyfusards, and they got in power through that and led France into World War I. And Charles Maurras, who was a big nationalist, who was also very anti-military, and so was Liebknecht, very anti-military, and yet he said Dreyfus was guilty. But Charles Maurras, I think he might have spent some time in prison because he was so anti-war in World War One. But he was so angry because he says, first they destroy the military, you know, do their best to weaken it, and then they lead our sons into war. You know, he was livid, you know. So there's some very interesting writing that if people read French, they can read. There's a, Maurras was an important writer, and there's a man, Maurice Barrès, who wrote something about the Rennes trial, and he describes Dreyfus coming in there. Very, very interesting, just what he looked like, and, you know, nobody liked him. All the Dreyfus arts were like, is this what we're fighting for?
I think that today in France, you wouldn't be able to find anybody who would want to change this verdict. I think they're very comfortable with it, and they've all become wonderful multiculturalists and so on. I know that there's a,
that's like the Holocaust in Germany, you know. I mean, you'd get attacked if you go to a party and say, oh, by the way, the Holocaust didn't happen. Yeah.
That's right. We used to, our people used to be so bad, but now we've changed and we're so good, and we don't have those feelings anymore. That's what I think everybody's stuck in, and that's really a sickness.
And that's their triumph, you know, their temporary, I hope, triumph.
Well, there's someone who's been listening to the show, and I thought I'd just ask them if they wanted to say anything. How about that, Margaret?
It's probably
Hattie. Hello, listener. Well, there is you. We can go over a little bit. We just got our 90-second warning, but we can go on over past the two-hour mark. So what would you like to add, Hattie?
Yeah. Well, I think that Blog Talk might dump the telephone, though. But actually, there's a footnote in Revelo Oliver's book, America's Decline, that says pretty much what Margaret's been saying, which is that there's not as much proof that Dreyfus was guilty as there is that the Jews used crooked means to secure his exoneration.
Yeah, but there's more than anybody says. If you don't read the trial testimony, you don't even realize how much there actually is.
I mean, and Oliver also shared Carolyn's suspicion that Esterhazy was a Jew, because he said that this Esterhazy called himself a count, and he was no count.
Yeah, he did, and you know, he also ended up in England. He died as a fake English nobleman. So.
That's very Jewy.
Oh, you know what I left out about that they killed Felix Faure, the president of France, who wouldn't allow a revision. They killed him by having a mistress go into his private quarters and supposedly have sex with him, and he died during sex. So they got rid of their president.
Oh, yeah, and you mentioned that woman. That woman who he's with.
Yeah, Margaret Steinheil,
She murdered her husband.
A Jewish woman, by chance. Husband and mother-in-law died, and she was tried for it and acquitted, after trying to frame her servant for it.
Okay.
So I got that in there.
that was pretty wild, too.
Yeah,
another
murder.
I'll just bring up that Hattie sent to me prior to the show that, he can speak for himself, actually. But
that image.
Go ahead.
That cartoon, that caricature that you had posted representing Dreyfus, that's not Dreyfus as a serpent, it's a Dreyfus as a hydra, or as one of the heads of a hydra. And usually a hydra is, you indicate, a monster that you cannot kill easily because it has so many heads, which would indicate that the Dreyfus was part of a larger Jewish problem, perhaps.
And in this case, he's sort of like the figurehead, but there are many other heads,
Well, I didn't see any other heads on that cartoon.
Well, they're to the side. Often a hydra is represented differently.
Yeah,
no serpent anyway. It's got legs.
It also says I looked up hydra, and it also said that they're especially interesting to biologists because of their regenerative ability.
But
and they appear not to
else.
Age or to die of old age. Hmm?
So are there really hydras?
There's a microorganism called a hydra that resembles in form the Greek mythical hydra, which was the monster slain by Heracles, I believe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and this real one lives in unpolluted freshwater ponds. See, this thing living in an unpolluted, like amongst white people, unpolluted freshwater ponds, lakes, and streams in the temperate and tropical regions.
Yeah. And if you inhale the water, it goes up into your brain and propagates?
I don't know. But I didn't have too much time to read all of it, but it was kind of interesting. Well, what would you say then, Hadding, is your what is your take on this at the bottom line of this whole Dreyfus affair thing? I gave mine, and I think Margaret gave hers.
Well, you know, it's I didn't have anything special to say about it, really. It's just that it's one example of the Jews overwhelming, you know, due process with a bunch of propaganda. They do it over and over again in various ways.
Well, exactly. It's a typical, it follows all the pattern. But this one, you know, it's really a kind of a solid thing for them. And if it could be broken into and mm-hmm. a little bit and have more doubts like Margaret is hoping for, and like happened with the Gliwice affair, but that's not as big as this Dreyfus thing. Well, I don't know. It supposedly started World War II, so I suppose it's pretty big.
Oh, you know, I had somebody bring up the Gliwice incident to me just yesterday, I think it was. And I have a response for that, which is there wasn't just one cross-border attack. There were many of them. And they only have the say-so of this one guy, Aljox, claiming that this Gliwice incident was a false flag. And just that one guy who's very suspect, if you look at his record, you know, he could be one of the many Germans that lied in order to save his own skin after the war. And if there were convicts that were dressed up in uniforms and shot, what's the name of one of them, right? And what about the families? Germany was not a society where you could just take prisoners and just kill them at random without the families being concerned about it, right? These people had families. They would want to know what happened.
Well,
but
also,
it's a totally crazy story.
So, we should be pointing out where this Dreyfus affair is also falls apart. Well, Margaret, I think you did a wonderful job. And I'm going to close the show now and give you an opportunity to give your closing remarks, whatever they might be.
Well, I'm in the process of doing this research because I'm going to be writing an article in the Barnes Review about it, and so then people could look for it there, and I'll try to get it online as well, and then maybe we can start the process of revising this. This huge lie.
Well, good for you for going into this. And of course, you've got the ability. You know French, and you know it very well. So that's what is required. So, all right. Well, thanks very much, Margaret Huffstickler.
Yeah, thank you, Carolyn.
And ladies and gentlemen, this has been the Heretics Hour on January 19th, 2015, and we'll see you again next week. Good night.